Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, back to school for students, and just a few are getting there on electric school buses. But New York State has mandated the switch to all electric buses in the next 10 years. We'll take a look at how local school districts and private school bus companies are responding. Attention artists, do you know all the resources available to support your work? The Delaware Valley Arts Alliance and New York Foundation for the Arts hosting an artist workshop this weekend focused on supporting artists on their artistic journey. We'll talk to the DVAA's Ariel Shanberg. Plus, Janice Adams celebrates poet Sonia Sanchez's 90th birthday, and photographer Noah Kalina is here not just taking pictures, he's also raising chickens and creating what he calls the best egg sandwich in the world. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Former President Donald Trump appeared in an hour-long interview last night with Fox News' Sean Hannity. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has more.
Hannity repeatedly praised Trump and criticized Kamala Harris during the interview, and the crowd interrupted several times to cheer loudly.
And we have to do the largest deportation in the history of...
Trump stuck to many of his usual talking points, for example, by casting undocumented immigrants as dangerous. He also criticized Harris for having only done one mainstream press interview since entering the race. In addition, Trump said, without evidence, that ABC News would provide Harris with the questions ahead of their debate next week. Again, he cited no evidence of this. The candidates will take part in that debate in Philadelphia on Tuesday. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Vice President Harris is going to Pittsburgh today to prepare for that debate next week. The event will be the first time that Harris and Trump have ever met. The rules will be similar to Trump's last debate with President Biden in June. The microphones for each candidate will be muted when it's not their turn to speak. People in the city of Winder, Georgia, are mourning the killings of two teachers and two students yesterday at Appalachie High School. The 14-year-old suspect is in custody, and authorities say he will be tried as an adult. Student Lila Syrath was on campus during the incident. She says the suspect left, then came back, but was not able to get into her classroom.
I saw students go back to open the door for him, and they backed away. I'm guessing they saw something, but for some reason they didn't open the door. And I can just see him kind of turn to the side, like what would have been my right, and you just hear gunshots.
The FBI says the suspect and his father were questioned last year by local officials about a potential school shooting, but the FBI says at the time, there was no reason to make an arrest. Stocks opened higher this morning as investors wait for news on the U.S. job market. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 15 points in early trading.
New claims for unemployment benefits fell last week in a sign that layoffs are still uncommon. Most employers are trying to hang on to the workers they have now, although they're not necessarily adding new ones as fast as they had been. Job openings have fallen to their lowest level in more than 3.5 years. The Labor Department will report tomorrow on employment and unemployment for the month of August. Verizon is buying rival telecom company Frontier Communications in a deal valued at $20 billion. Frontier's invested heavily in its fiber optic network. And golf club maker Callaway plans to spin off its driving range business, Topgolf. Callaway had acquired Topgolf less than 4 years ago. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow has now turned negative. It's down about 4 points. The Nasdaq is up more than 170 points at 17,260. This is NPR. The World Health Organization says it's starting the second phase of its polio vaccination campaign in Gaza. So far, they've given more than 180,000 doses to Palestinian children. There's been a pause in hostilities in southern Gaza for this campaign. German police shot and killed a man in an exchange of gunfire today. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports it happened near the Israeli consulate and a Nazi history museum in Munich.
Munich police say they exchanged fire with a man who was carrying a long-barreled gun in central Munich. The man died from his wounds, and there were no indications of other suspects. Police have not yet identified the man or his motive, but the incident occurred on the 52nd anniversary of the 1972 attack at the Olympic Games in Munich, when Palestinian gunmen murdered 11 Israeli athletes. The Israeli Foreign Ministry said the consulate in Munich was closed for a commemoration of the event, and no one from the consulate staff was injured in the incident. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Federal prosecutors and lawyers for Donald Trump will be in a federal courtroom in Washington today. Trump is accused of interfering in the peaceful transfer of power in 2021. He denies this. This case was on hold until the U.S. Supreme Court ruled this summer that Trump is presumptively immune from criminal liability for his official acts. Weather forecasters say more than 70 million people are under heat cautions today, mostly in the West. Phoenix may hit 111 degrees today. The Arizona Capitol has had more than 100 days in a row of 100-degree heat or hotter. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Kids are back to school in most of our listening area this week, and many are still getting there on gas-guzzling yellow school buses. But after 2027, New York will not allow public schools to purchase gas-powered buses, and entire fleets must run on batteries by 2035. This mandate aligns with the state's Climate Act goals to reduce greenhouse gases and air pollution. The transition will be supported by over $500 million in Environmental Bond Act funding and a $5 billion federal allocation from the Environmental Protection Agency. However, many school districts, including Monticello Central School District here in Sullivan County, have expressed concerns about feasibility, grid support, and costs. Radio Catskill reporter Chia Tien Nicole Chen has this report on how local school districts and private school bus companies are responding to the state mandate.
In April of 2022, New York passed a state budget that included an ambitious mandate to require all school districts in the state to stop buying diesel and gas school buses by 2027 and to transition to all electric bus fleets by 2035. The electric school bus mandate is part of New York's Climate Act goals to cut down greenhouse gas emissions statewide. It's also intended to reduce air pollution from diesel and gas-powered engines, which emit toxic air pollutants linked to lung and heart diseases. To facilitate this transition to electric, the state has set aside over $500 million in Environmental Bond Act funding. Through the New York State Research and Development Authority, school districts and third-party bus operators can apply for grants and rebates, which can cover a large percentage of the upfront costs of purchasing a bus, installing charging stations, and electrical upgrades. The Environmental Protection Agency has also allocated $5 billion in federal dollars for the purchase of clean school buses, which schools nationwide can apply for. Though these resources exist, many school districts are wondering about the feasibility of fully electrifying New York school buses within the mandate's timeline.
I think many of my colleagues would express the same trepidations that I've shared about how is this all going to work, where's the grid going to come from, and how are we going to support it? However, the state and federal government's going to support it financially.
That's Matthew Evans, the superintendent of Monticello Central School District in Sullivan County. In March, Monticello received its first electric school bus, which was funded with a rebate from the EPA. When I spoke to Evans in June, he told me that Monticello was still in a data gathering phase with the bus.
It seems to be going well. It seems to get to and from their destinations on time and without issue. The charging station is working very well. It's operating great, but it's a new vehicle, so one would expect a three-month-old vehicle to operate great.
I also spoke to the director of transportation at Monticello Schools, Robin Sklar. She told me that students seem to enjoy the relative quietness of the new bus's electric motor as opposed to the rumble of a diesel engine. And she also told me that learning to drive an electric bus with its regenerative braking technology had gone smoothly for the drivers on her team. The challenge of a quick transition to electric, Sklar said, is figuring out the logistics of running a full fleet, working out a charging and bus route schedule, and planning for emergencies such as power outages, and learning how to maintain an electric bus. In our conversation, Sklar seemed optimistic about her team's ability to learn, adapt, and take on those challenges, but the district will have to figure out how to acquire a fleet of over 50 electric vehicles first.
Right now, everything's good. It's just a matter of how do we bring it to scale. How do we afford bringing it to scale, and how will the grid support that scale as well? We have more than 50 buses at our station during the day, you know, in between runs. Certainly plugging them in either midday or overnight is going to put a strain on the existing grid, not only the energy that's being fueled directly to our bus garage, but also the line in general.
Monticello's first electric school bus cost $375,000, which was covered by the EPA rebate. An equivalent diesel bus would have cost between $90,000 and $110,000. New York State has 731 school districts and around 50,000 school buses. And the expenses of transitioning to an entire bus fleet will not just include the costs of buses, but also chargers, infrastructural upgrades, planning, and training. Empire Center, a conservative think tank in Albany, has crunched the numbers. According to its report on the electric school bus transition, all the potential federal and state funding sources would be enough to pay only for around 5,000 electric buses. This spring, in multiple school districts throughout the North County and Central New York, voters rejected budget propositions to purchase electric school buses. Without voter approval, school districts cannot spend the funds necessary to meet the electrification mandate. But even those who don't need voter approval anticipate encountering major hurdles.
Everybody thinks the school bus is this thing that just, since you were a kid, showed up on time. Mind you, every single day and got you to school and brought you home. But there is an entire economy behind it that is very, very complicated.
Nick Vallone is the executive vice president of Rolling V, a private school bus company that services school districts in Sullivan and Rockland counties. Rolling V has a fleet of 280 vehicles and a team of 400 employees, including bus mechanics, monitors, drivers, and managers. Monticello Central School District owns and operates its own buses. But a majority of school districts in New York rely upon private contractors like Rolling V to provide transportation services.
Private school bus contractors provide almost 60% of school transportation in New York, and 40%, a little more than that, are district run. And that means the district owns and operates and employs the drivers and the vehicles.
Vallone was previously the president of the New York School Bus Contractors Association. In that role, he sat on the board that advised NYSERDA when it was developing its roadmap for electrifying New York school buses. And with me, he was pretty forthcoming with his doubts about the mandate's feasibility.
2035 certainly is far-fetched, especially 2027 with the purchase moratorium is even more difficult. There are a million hurdles that we can talk about in order to get there. I myself, over the past 3 years, being very, very close to the issue, especially being up in Albany and working with our lawmakers, there is a sense of reality that exists up there, but sometimes it's just slower to get out to the rest of us, right?
Vallone shares Superintendent Evans' concerns and then some. He appeared to be skeptical about the power grid's ability to support all the new electric buses.
There is a grid issue and an infrastructure issue first. Scrambling to figure out where this additional power in Sullivan County, Ulster County, Delaware County in particular, is going to be coming from. And it's really a who's on first situation with dealing with the utility companies.
And he expressed concerns about funding, both about the relative expense of electric versus conventional buses, and also about the dependability of the existing federal funds, which are released in stages.
We are in an election year. We don't know what's going to happen. But if the presidency goes Republican this year, you're going to see a new EPA January 2nd. And the remaining funds in the EPA are certainly, by all indications, going to be gone. But the existing funds that have existed for the last 3 years and returned do stay in the pot. So there will be a sense of federal funding no matter what happens this year. But I think it's safe to say any future funding is going to come off the table there.
Rolling V hasn't purchased an electric bus yet, though they're looking into applying for funding from the EPA and NYSERDA. Private contractors can apply for state and federal funds with authorization from school districts, and that's what a private contractor in Orange County has been doing.
My name is Daniel Higby. I'm the general manager for Mid-City Transit. We're owned by the second largest school bus contractor in the country called Student Transportation of America. We have locations here in Middletown and in Newburgh. We now have three locations as well.
Mid-City Transit serves Middletown and Large City School District, which was one of the first districts in upstate New York to get electric buses. It got four of them at once in March of 2023, and the buses have been running for well over a year through all four seasons.
The electric buses have worked out great for us. It's a perfect scenario for electrification because even though our buses do multiple routes morning and afternoon, it's very easy for us to find routes that will work with an electric school bus. Because we are a 25 square mile school district, the mileages are low enough where we can do that with very minimal charge. We weren't sure about the range of the bus and we weren't 100% confident in the product. So we chose based on routes and based on drivers, which four routes and drivers we thought would be a good fit. Having had the buses now for 16, 17 months, we have a lot more confidence in the bus and a lot more confidence in the product. Compared to the diesel bus, the electric bus is much, much quieter. And you really notice it a lot when you're in the bus as a passenger. My four electric school bus drivers are extremely happy and proud of their buses, and they love their buses. And the scholars that we transport, they definitely notice a difference. And the buses themselves have been a very positive addition to our school district.
Higby is a proponent of the electric school bus, and he is quick to respond to skeptics of the technology.
There is falsehoods about the buses not being able to go up hills. The buses actually go up hills better than any diesel bus. But I've heard a couple of districts say, oh, we have too hilly of a terrain. Not true. I've heard people say that they're not good in the snow. They actually are better in the snow than a diesel bus because of the way that the weight is distributed in the center of the bus. I've also heard people say that the range, is half in the winter. The range is not half in the winter. The range goes down in the winter. But if you precondition your batteries, that cuts down drastically on the winter things.
But even with his confidence in the technology, Higby is conscious of the infrastructure and logistical hurdles. He told me that there isn't an affordable electric option for the smaller 7-passenger cars needed for longer routes out of the school district. And the shorter range of electric buses means that there isn't a good option for long field trips out to other districts like Syracuse. And then there's the cost of electricity.
One thing that we never took into consideration is the cost of electricity versus the cost of fossil fuels, diesel fuel and gasoline. Right now we are charging four buses with one charger. So as you can imagine, we're charging around the clock in some cases. So especially when we're charging buses during the day, our supply charge and our demand charges are high. So one thing that we never took into consideration is the price per mile on electricity is costing us more per mile than it would be on diesel or gasoline. So that is one thing to consider, is that the pure cost. We did do a power assessment, and to charge our 145 buses, it's an absolutely huge power plant that we need. 2 megawatt we need, which is, just an unheard of amount of power.
So I asked him, considering all of these hurdles, does the current timeline seem feasible?
I think getting the actual buses for the 2027 start, the buses are not a problem. The buses the manufacturers can make. Now that there's grant money available, you can get pretty close to the amount of grant versus the cost. But I go back to the infrastructure part. That's very challenging.
And do you feel optimistic about Mid-City Transit getting there by 2035?
I do think that it at this point in time, it would be near impossible to, even with our positive attitude and our supportive school district. Our school district has been so supportive of our electrification efforts, and our school district has been phenomenal about helping us, even with the grants, and they've been great, and they're excited about the electric school buses too.
This electric school bus mandate, it's unworkable, it's unreasonable, and it's unattainable.
That's the New York State Assembly Minority Leader William Barclay speaking at a press conference in February. He's one of the state lawmakers backing a Republican bill that would repeal the electric school bus mandate. Here's Republican Assembly Member Phil Palmisano explaining what the bill proposes.
Number one, it would delay the requirement of all new school bus purchases or leases that must be zero emission by 2027 to July of 2045, or until the state has converted their entire heavy-duty fleet.
The bill also proposes having a cost-benefit analysis completed for every school district in the state. If the analysis concludes that the proposed 2045 deadline is unfeasible for a specific district, the district can then receive an extension of up to 24 months. As of now, the bill is being considered by the New York State Assembly's Education Committee. In June, Governor Kathy Hochul defended the school bus mandate.
Sometimes it's an education process for people to understand. I know school districts and voters don't want to be told what to do, but this is for the children's health now and into the future. So there's an education process that has to continue. The state can help at even greater levels to help these school districts meet these demands. Again, it's about our children.
When asked if she'd considered delaying the timeline, Governor Hochul said,
"That is something that'd be up to the legislature, because this was the law that was drafted back in 2019, enacted by my predecessor and the legislature, and we are required to follow that at this time."
Monticello Superintendent Matthew Evans is not holding his breath. Here's what he told me back in June.
"We're planning as if there will be no change. Right now, you know, as far as I know, come July 1st, 2027, we won't be able to buy any new fuel-powered vehicles. And then come July 1st, 2034,
2035,
we won't be able to run any more fuel-powered vehicles. They'll have to be electric. So, yeah, that's what we're operating under now. It's a politically charged issue for some. We don't get into that. We merely follow what comes to us from Albany, and we do seek support in it. We do raise questions about it. We want to know how the grid is going to support this. It's not so much as, you know, yay, let's do this all right now and hope we'll beat the state deadlines. It's more of, okay, if that's what it is, then how do we get there on time?"
Nick Vallone of Rolling V told me that he'd like to see a more gradual transition.
"Where both diesel, gas, and electric exist simultaneously would be the first thing. And then when you can establish that, maybe you can keep the 2035 deadline, right? Maybe, but then what we'd like to see is the steps between today and 2035. Right now, all we have is two dates. But if you tell me 5% a year for the next 10 years to get to 50%, that becomes framework for a project in which we can work."
But regardless of the feasibility of the mandate, Vallone told me that there's one thing he finds comfort in.
"The one thing that is encouraging about what we do in school transportation is that our job is way more important than delivering packages or delivering fuel, right? We're transporting students, and I firmly believe that no mandate is going to get in the way of us being able to continue to do that. So I really think that there is a sense of reality out there and that there is a lag in communication on that."
It's the beginning of the school year, and the yellow school buses are back on the road once again, getting students to school and back safely. And regardless of what's under the hood, that's one thing that will remain the same. It's Jatia Nicole Chen for Radio Catskill.
And thank you for that. We'll take a break. When we come back, Janice Adams celebrating poet Sonia Sanchez's 90th birthday with a special tribute and special interview. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Join us for Radio Catskill's 2024 Community Awards, September 12th, honoring individuals dedicated to environmental stewardship and sustainability, including Lori Ramey of the Upper Delaware Council and Lisa Lyons of Morgan Outdoors. Celebrate their hard work and commitment to healthier and more sustainable local communities at the 2024 Radio Catskill Community Awards, September 12th at La Sagone, Narrowsburg. Get your tickets now at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Janice Adams is an Emmy Award-winning journalist, author, speaker, and, of course, the host of The Janice Adams Show, heard here on Radio Catskill every Saturday morning at 11. She's joining us this morning with a special tribute to poet Sonia Sanchez and a special interview. Janice, good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Yeah. Hi. So, you know, the special interview is something from the archives. Many folks know you for, you know, your work as a journalist and here on the Janice Adams Show. But you got your start back at an NPR member station, WFCR, on the campus of UMass in Amherst, University of Massachusetts. And that's where this interview we're going to listen to comes from, right? Tell us a little bit about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And actually, I mean, I'm outing myself with this interview anyway, you know, and in that I actually got my start in radio and television in 1970. I am feeling so young these days. And this interview was done in 1974. It aired November 30th, 1974. And it's always amazing when you do these things. This was a gift to my dear friend Sonia Sanchez for this 90th birthday. And I'd been celebrating her birthday all along. We'd been COVIDed in. And this year we decided we were going to do a major tribute to her in person. And in the process of saying, let's make this special, this is what came up. My own interview with her from an archive at UMass. And it is just, well, you'll hear it. Obviously, we will play a clip from it. But I think it's important to also, especially in the times that we're in now, recognizing the times that we were in then. 1974, this is just, it was November 1974 when it aired. So it's just 4 months after Nixon's resignation. That's, you know, yeah. That's something.
And Sonia Sanchez, as you mentioned, a dear friend, author of more than 20 books, a playwright, activist scholar, leading figure of the Black arts movement. She inspired generations of writers and scholars. And this interview that you have with her from 50 years ago will mm-hmm. give us more background on her, but also get folks to understand a little bit more about the context of what we're talking about, too, in when this actually aired.
Exactly. Thank you, Tim, for that. The thing is that Sonia is so important because she's been through so much, and she's stayed on message and on focus about human rights, human dignity, and demanding it. So when we say that we came through this Nixon era, we're talking about the Nixon enemies list. We're talking about the smearing of people, the legacy of Nixon, not only the Watergate stuff, but what led up to it. His participation, or let's say cooperation, in perpetuating McCarthyism. At the same time that this Sonia Sanchez interview is done, I have had my 100th show on a series that I premiered, The World of Women, and it was like, it was a pioneering show because there had not been in the United States at that point any issue-oriented women shows. There were mommy shows, not to deride mothers, of which I am one, but that was the attitude of how you treated women on air, and this was an issue-oriented show. One show, number 100, was with Helen Gehagan Douglas, who was the woman when Nixon was running for Senate, happened in the era of black and white TV to wear a pink dress, and he then seized on that to smear her as a pinko in these red-baiting days. And in a way, he got his comeuppance at last with the Watergate hearings. But I did my 100th show with Helen Gehagan Douglas, who had lived through that era of being tarnished and smeared, not unlike what people are trying to do now. And so when we look at this interview with Sonia Sanchez in November of that same year, we're talking about a woman who, for being a poet, for saying no to racism, no to sexism, has been followed by the FBI simply for that.
Yeah, let's take a listen. This is Janice Adams interviewing poet Sonia Sanchez from November 30th, 1974 on WFCR at UMass in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Given this show tonight a title, 10 Years a Poet, and before you read for us, if you will, mm-hmm. I'd like to have you tell the audience something about coming and the transitions of Sonia Sanchez from Alabama to New York and beyond that, even to China last year.
Right. I understand what you meant by saying 10 years a poet, but if you understand people who write poetry, it's a lifetime of poetry. Mm-hmm. It's a time from writing poetry as a child. As a child, I stuttered. As a consequence, I wrote poetry. I started to write because quite often people didn't understand what you were saying. People have no patience with stutterers, if you can understand that. So therefore, I was able to communicate not only with other people, but with myself via the written word. And when I first started to write poetry, I don't really know. I know I did it in Alabama, and I didn't show it to anyone. And I know I did it in New York City. And the first time my family was aware of that was when I think I was about 11 or 12, on a holiday from school, my sister found a poem I had done to George Washington. It's a poem called George Washington Crossing the Delaware. And she came out with the poem. She had been searching for something, and she came out with this poem I had hidden in my drawer. And she stood up in the hallway, and I can still see it now because it was quite traumatic for me. She stood up in the hallway and she read it, dun 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 dun, and then she fell out laughing, and she said, "This is what you do in the room sometimes, writing dumb poetry." And from then on, I really hit my poetry. Mm. And then from there, I wrote poetry in junior high school and never showed it to anyone. And then I got into high school and got into a literary club, where then I dared to show my poetry to a teacher who kind of like looked at it and didn't really say anything one way or another. Then I wrote in college, and someone asked me what did I want to do, and I said I want to be a writer, and she kind of like fell out. You know, she told me that most whites couldn't support themselves writing, so how could I, you know, do that? So it was best for me if I would then become a teacher or a social worker and really, you know, do something with my life instead of having all these wild dreams about being a writer. It was really a crushing experience, considering I went into Hunt at 16, and, you know, which is a very, I mean, it's a time when you just are seeking, and I went in hope saying that I wanted to learn. And I stopped writing, and I didn't write anymore until I came across some people who were writing also, saying things in the 60s, you know, the same things that, like, I had been thinking all along. And I started to write again. And I think I also mentioned to you that I took a course with Louise Bogan, who taught a course on creative writing. And in that group, I think there were about 7 or 8 of us who kind of, like, looked at each other and thought we were the better writers. And they came over to me and said, "Would you like to join this writer's workshop?" And we met for about 2-3 years. And the thing that was good about that was that in order to come to each meeting, you had to bring a work. And that was really good discipline. So even though sometimes on a Wednesday before I went to the workshop, I might not have written anything the entire week, about an hour before my trip, I'd sit down and just start writing something. But it made me become accustomed to discipline, the discipline of writing and writing when I had to. So I can sit down quite often and make myself write, you know, or if I know I'm on a schedule, you know, a deadline, I'll sit down and write. You know, it was very good discipline for me. So I've always seen things, you know, I suppose through a poet's eyes. You know, when I was a child, I used to make up stories, and my family used to call them lies, but I called them, I really used to say, but it was a good, you know, a good story, and it sounded good to me. And they constantly tried to push that out of me, that kind of creativity. They didn't ever play with it and make me deal with it. They just said, if they asked me, where were you, I would say, oh, I was outside, and I would make up some fantastic thing, which very obviously I had not been doing because they had seen me out there. But they didn't deal with that creativity or that imagination. They said, oh, stop lying. And so therefore they relegated me to lying. And I knew I wasn't lying. I said, oh, yeah, right, I wasn't doing that, but it sounded good. And that's the kind of imagination that I had all my life, you know. And sometimes it comes in handy. I like to read from poem called All Words. There's a quote which is from something that I had said. We are the dead ones, the slow, fast suicides of our time. We are the disenfranchised ones, the buyers of bread one day removed from mold. We are maimed in our posture. One, did you hear me start my hurting song that summer night? It is autumn now, and the night multiplies by threes. Can you hear me, poet? One sound was you, and as I sang you, blue mass marched from your face, holy with stains. O mass produced faces, I have burned myself out. Now my ashes have no place to lean. Sing it, Billy Baby. Sing away that ill wind blowing you no good, no good, ill wind. Spread your strange fruit amid these stones. We all strangers here. Sing, I hear your words quivering with silks. I smell your black soul, sweet. Two. It is horrible to be. Gigantic fornicators advance towards me shrieking maternity cries. And as I run, I trip over my deformity. This is a fool's world. Pain is an idiot's ailment, for the wise man knows how to reconnoiter pain and make it colloquial. Go, prez man, go now. Move those plastic hands up and down that sax. Blow, man, blow. Ride your saxophone across the stage and back again. We all riders here. Blow, man. Can't you see this transfixed audience staring at you while you bleed? Blow, ride, bleed, blow, ride. Three. Are we ever what we should be? Seated in our circle of agonies, we do not try to tune our breaths. Since we cannot sing together, since we cannot waltz our eyes, since we cannot love, since we have wooed this world too long with separate areas of revolution, mysticism, hatred, and submission, since we have rehearsed our deaths apart, now, let us abandon past heresies now, when small men stretch for greatness via wars on poverty. In the 20th century, at a time of punitive, contaminated, repressive wars, when men disfigure their bodies to become holy in space and walk without footsteps, in the 20th century, at a time of grinning life-copyrighted astronauts, when men stuff their mouths with murderous soliloquies and urinate on hungry faces, in the 20th century, at a time of illiterate, adulterous, industrious hungers, we have come to believe that we are not. To be, we must be loved or touched and proved to be. This earth turns old and rivers grow lunatic with rain. How I wish I could lean in your cave and creak with the winds. That's a poem called All Words, which is in three parts. And behind that long poem, I like to do a short one. I did quite a number of hakus in this book, which is Japanese syllabic verse, three lines. If I had known you, I would have left my love at home. Which is kind of like a real one. Haku, when I felt your warm touch, I swelled up until the streets were filled with you. Haku, your love was a port of call where many ships docked until morning came. Which sometimes is real. And a haiku I wrote from Peking because, you know, I greeted the day before the people I loved saw the day. So I said, let me wear the day well, so when it reaches you, you will enjoy it. Which, something I wrote to my family.
That is poet Sonia Sanchez speaking to Janice Adams on her show World of Women, which aired on at WFCR, an NPR station at UMass in Amherst, from November 30th, 1974. Janice, thank you so much for sharing that with us. What a special thing to hear, and what great poetry from Sonia Sanchez.
She is an amazing poet, and as she says at the top of that interview, she came to poetry because she was a stutterer. Yeah. And that is what gave her the necessity to write. You know, in doing this interview, I really was grateful for the legacy of public radio, because that's really how it came about. It came about because I was asked to do this show where that no commercial station would have touched. It was WFCR, for people listening in this area, had a six-state footprint. It actually was the stronger talk and news station than WGBH, which we all know from, you know, public television and bringing us Masterpiece Theater, and they had a strong radio station, but it was mostly European classical music. WAMC, that we know now in our area as the strongest station, was a startup station also and did not have the footprint that it had. We had a six-state area, and we used it to do with the women's movement, just coming of age, or the modern women's movement, I'll put it that way, just coming of age, and the African-American civil rights movement. You know, this is just 6 years after Dr. King has been assassinated.
Yes.
It's in all of that. And it was only public radio that allowed us to document these things.
Yeah. And you're carrying, of course, that legacy on here. We're so honored and privileged to have you on the Janice Adams Show every Saturday morning at 11. Before we go, can you tell us what you have coming up this Saturday?
Yes, this Saturday, actually, we are continuing my summer series called, this one is OMG, Yes We Have, Kamala Harris, a tribute to her, women in leadership, and especially in this case, black women and leadership, but women and leadership. And so this Saturday is an interview with Spring Washam, the author of The Spirit of Harriet Tubman, a conversation across history, herstory, and belief systems brought together by that phenomenal human rights activist, Harriet Tubman.
That's the Janice Adams Show, Saturday morning at 11 here on Radio Catskill. More information about Janice at her website, janiceadams.com. Janice, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Tim, thank you as ever for having me, and thank you for making sure we keep public radio going.
Thank you.
All
right. Quick break, and we'll be back with Ariel Schamberg from the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, our award-winning series from 2020, when I traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border, starting in El Paso and then Ciudad Juarez for part one of The Moving Border.
CBP recibe a 10 personas hoy ingresando por la tarde. Nos quedamos en el número 19,428.
That's This Week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. Attention artists, do you know all the resources available to you? Well, the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, along with the New York Foundation for the Arts, wants to let you in on some information and some development opportunities, some grants and more to help you on your artistic journey. They've got a workshop for artists this weekend, and here to tell us more is Executive Director of the DVAA, Ariel Schamberg. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
So what are some of these things that are available to artists, and what's this workshop all about?
So we are hosting the NISCA NYFA Artist as Entrepreneur workshop this weekend. And this was is a 3.5-day workshop that we had an open call for in the spring. And an incredible number of artists from the region applied, and 30 were selected. What we felt was really important was in bringing this workshop and all these resources is providing a couple of public programs, so that even people who maybe didn't know about the opportunity when it came about could benefit from the great wealth of knowledge that's coming to Narrowsburg this week. So Saturday at the Tustin Theater from 4:30 to 5:30, we're hosting a joint presentation on opportunities for artists. And this is visual artists, writers, performers, dancers, anybody who identifies as an artist. Yes. Sorry, no microbrewers or
you'll have your chance.
But textile artists, installation artists, everybody is this is an opportunity for them to come in here and learn about things like the New York Foundation for the Arts annual individual artist fellowships, which are awards of about $7,500 that go to throughout the state. They're selected by their peers. So panels of artists are compiled and they are medium specific, and they are a great way to bolster the ability for an artist to make their work, to take time and maybe not take that side gig give themselves a self-paid residency. And that's some of the other things we'll talk about.
Were you encouraged by the number of people applying for this? Because many artists may not think of themselves as entrepreneurs, but that people are looking at their art as a commodity in a way of, letting more folks see it and also benefit from it.
Absolutely. I think I always am inspired by a report that the Center for Urban Futures put out last fall, actually, called the Upstate's Creative Spark. And what it spotlighted was over the past 5 to 6 years, the artist community has been one of the fastest growing communities in upstate New York. And that includes the Mid-Hudson Valley, the Catskills, Capital Region, Western New York. And they're all entrepreneurial in their practice. They're opening businesses. They're being part of the community in dynamic ways. And a program like this is going to give the participants the opportunity to focus on marketing, on strategic planning, but also learn from each other. So it's not just the presenters. So that's something that I've always felt, that if you bring in a group of really passionate, creative people together, that they are going to learn as much from each other as they're going to learn from the presenters.
And just to clarify, there's a talk on Friday, and there's also something on Saturday. Is it the same?
There's also an arts administrator mixer. So this is for people who are on the facilitation side of things, and that is today from 3:30 to 4:30 at DVAA in Gloria Krauss Recital Hall, and folks can RSVP on our website to attend that. And that's a chance for all the kind of opportunity providers, the curators, the administrators, folks who are looking to work with artists and help for them to realize their entrepreneurial goals to attend and get to know each other and, collaborate.
How important is for you as executive director of DVAA, not just mounting a show and showing off people's work, but giving them these resources and showing them what you can do, what the state's trying to do, what other community organizations are trying to do to support?
It's a vital part of our work. As some of your listeners may know, DVAA is a re-granting organization as part of our role as an arts space. So every year we work with the New York State Council on the Arts and through support from the county to distribute funding to arts organizations and artists. And building a strong, vibrant, creative cultural community in Sullivan County and in the Sullivan Catskills is a central part of our mission. So these opportunities to bring people together, to network, to grow their practice and learn about resources is at the heart of what DVAA does.
let's remind folks, artists of all disciplines, where they can get more information and RSVP. It's a free event, but you're asking folks to RSVP.
We are asking for them to RSVP, and they can visit us online at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org, the whole thing, and it's arts plural. And they'll find information very easily on the event and how to RSVP.
While we have you, any fall preview you want to sneak in here?
Oh, my goodness. Well, in the midst of all of this, Retro Cinema comes back to the Tustin Theater this Friday with 2001, A Space Odyssey, and you don't want to disappoint Hal. And then as new shows later this month, featuring Dale Emmert and Margaret Inge Arias, as well as a very special window pop-up being created by Matt Nolan and Leslie LaFranc. So mark September 21st on your calendars. And hope to have our grants manager, Tanner Simon, come on soon to talk about our 2025 grant cycle, which will include individual artist fellowships.
And pin a note for November to the 20th annual Art and Sixes Small Work Show, which is always fun, too. So, Ariel Schamberg from Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, the best egg sandwich in the world. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's Electric Mountain, featuring the very best of global dance music. I play the best of dance music from back in the day to today, and every week I'll feature a guest DJ spinning a continuous set bringing their unique style. Come dance with us on Electric Mountain each and every Saturday night from 12 to 2, exclusively on Radio Catskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl, and the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. Photographer Noah Kalina isn't just making photographs. He's also raising chickens and creating what he calls, quote, the best egg sandwich in the world. In his latest newsletter, he introduces his readers to his Green Queen Easter Egger Bantam chickens, and he's crafted together with them the Emerald Egg Sandwich. Noah Kalina is here to tell us about that. We've also got Patricio Rubio here, too, because we, Noah, are both intrigued. You've got the whole studio, the whole staff here intrigued. The best egg sandwich in the world.
Well, I mean, that's what some people are saying. One guy said that, actually. But yeah.
And that was you.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, so I've been raising chickens for maybe 8 years or so. And I got this new breed that lays green eggs. And I think a lot of listeners probably know about how certain chicken breeds will lay different colored eggs. So these happen to be green, and I just wanted to do something special with them instead of just eat them myself. My friend, Shane, runs a brand new food cart down in Barryville, and he makes egg sandwiches. So I spoke to him, and I was like, hey, do you want to use my eggs? Let's make a premium egg sandwich, you know, for people who might want something a little special. And let's use those eggs. And together we put together something, you know, special. Green eggs. Obviously, they're normal eggs. Just because the eggs are green doesn't mean the eggs taste any different. But it's smoked pork belly, cheddar, cheese, beautiful roll. It's just a great egg sandwich and a fun thing to go down into Barryville and grab an egg sandwich.
So Shane runs the River Eatery in Barryville. That's and right. Was open to taking the eggs from those chickens, Jay, Mouse, Sally, and Opal.
Yeah, that's right.
So, and at one point you guys were talking about like a high price point for this egg sandwich. You were calling it the $100 chicken egg sandwich.
You know, that was my original idea because, you know, this is a small operation. There's only five hens laying. So, you know, if you do the math on that, the cost per egg, you know, back of the napkin math, I mean, These are like $60, $70 eggs a piece, you know, my cost.
So did you decided though for economic reasons to maybe lower that price point?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, we
wanted to make it more accessible.
Exactly. We needed to be a little more accessible to the community. This is a $15 egg sandwich. Shane does offer a normal egg sandwich for, I think, $6 or something. It's something affordable. The locals do like the price of the normal sandwiches and all the food on the menu there. But this one, just because of the premium ingredients, we, you know, had to charge a little more.
Now, you're a well-known photographer. You have a following on your newsletter, podcasts as well. Is this a new branch of your world here, your life? What are we moving toward egg sandwiches and chicken raising?
Probably not. it was a good, but maybe we'll see how it goes starting tomorrow. If people, you know, people start lining up for this, maybe we bring it nationwide. But no, it's just a fun project that we're doing. You know, I wanted to help Shane out down, you know, down there. We'll get more people to come on down, check out his food truck. So yeah, I mean, just another sort of concept that I had for the stories that I tell in the newsletter. And we'll see where it goes.
Well, and in the newsletter, you do take your regular photography work and showcase these chickens. Are they good subjects for you? They look pretty.
They are pretty chickens. And, you know, I've had a whole range of chickens over the years. Some are better models than others. So these happen to not be all that cooperative. They're harder to get to stay still.
They're divas.
They are.
They know they've got the best egg sandwich in the world, so they're acting like it.
So, you know, we've spoken a little bit off the air, but has it changed your sort of perspective on living up here, raising chickens?
Yeah, you know, I think like a lot of people, you know, you just think chicken, you just think it's a yellow bird that lays eggs and you eat it in a sandwich or something. Before I started raising chickens, I had no idea how just wonderful and special this breed of animal is. So it definitely just like changed how I look at the world. And meanwhile, there's so many expressions from raising chickens that you hear on a daily basis, but you don't even think twice about.
Like what?
Flying the coop. Right. Don't count your chickens before they lay.
Yeah, that's one. Yeah.
Birds of a feather.
Flock together.
Yeah. So all of these things you hear and you know them, but then you see it and you're like, oh, the world makes a little more sense now.
You might be on trend here because on NPR earlier this week, maybe even yesterday, there was something on All Things Considered with one of the NPR correspondents about raising chickens and how she used that to get her back to exercising because she didn't want to go to the gym. And so chasing the chickens around.
Definitely.
Good exercise too.
It is. It can be dangerous though. Oh. You know, when you're running around and then you can trip. And so that's absolutely true. Trying to catch a chicken is not easy. Just make sure you remove any obstacles around you.
Especially if they're, you know, divas.
Yeah.
Not cooperative.
It's funny because they all have different personalities. I think that's something people don't know about chickens is some are just aloof and, you know, they're just a chicken, but then some end up with names because they have just wonderful personalities and, you know, and then they might be less skittish if that's the case. And then you can easily grab them and hold them.
And love them.
Yeah, exactly.
And take their green eggs and make the best egg sandwich in the world. Let's remind folks where they can get that sandwich and starting when.
The River Eatery down in Barryville, downtown Barryville, right in the parking lot of the old Barryville General, starting tomorrow, Friday. And they are open 8 a.m. to 3 p.m.
All right. And where can folks get more information on you and your newsletter?
Just go to noahkalina.com. You'll find information about me. You'll find a link to my newsletter where you can sign up. And I also make YouTube videos as well.
Noah Kalina, he is not chickening out. I see what he did there.
I like that.
Thanks for joining us, and thanks for bringing us the best egg sandwich, as known by one, at least, in the world.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear this episode and all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Chatskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union. And Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning,
markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, mostly sunny, clear tonight, low 49. Expect a showery weather tomorrow night through early Saturday evening. Tomorrow, high 73, and then on Saturday, not as warm, that rain, a high of 66. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.